Welcome to the I Create Daily podcast. I'm Leora Alderson.
And I'm Devani Alderson. We're your co-hosts on this journey of creativity and productivity.
I Create Daily is for artists in every genre of creating, from musicians to writers, crafters to inventors, bloggers to entrepreneurs. I Create Daily is a movement for creators serious about your art.
If you're into creating anything, this podcast is definitely for you. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey. You're starting.
Oh, I am. I thought you were introducing. Okay, it's me. All right, great. So welcome to I Create Daily, a movement for creators serious about their art. I'm Leora.
And I'm Devani. And today our guest is Tim Lewis. Tim is the host of the Being Self-Published podcast, founder of Stoneham Press, a London-based publishing company, and the author of 3 fantasy and sci-fi novels. So welcome, Tim.
Hi, well, welcome. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to authors, especially published fiction authors. And you in particular have a unique situation with, you also run a company that helps authors learn how to self-publish, right?
And yeah.
Publish and all that. So we look forward to diving into all that. You have a tremendous amount of content about that on your website, which of course we'll link in the show notes. But tell us first, how did you go from being whatever you were doing before to, are you a full-time writer?
I would say I'm probably not at the moment,
Okay. But
that's because I podcast a lot and I do a lot of social media stuff as well. So I would say I'm a part-time, and sometimes very part-time, generally in burst writer.
Okay. So are you doing any other kind of business or work? Like, in other words, do you have a job while you're growing your creative pursuits, or are your creative pursuits now supporting you and also your primary work?
Well, I would say that my creative pursuits are my primary work, but it's generally other income that's maintaining me rather than the creative pursuits, so to speak. Okay. But shall I answer your question about where I came from?
Though, sorry for jumping all around there because...
Yeah.
I realized I didn't know if you were a full-time author. So yeah, let's start with your journey, how you got to be doing what you're doing, and then we can proceed from there.
Well, I'm not going to start at the day I was born because it's a bit too far back. But I was an IT professional. I worked in a company in the City of London where there's a lot of financial stuff. And I worked on an IT system there for almost 18 years. Now, the ultimate trigger for what changed my life was that I was widowed in 2011. And that both changed my perspective in terms of changing from just the day-to-day grind that everybody's always in, where you've got your job, you go in, you do your job. I had the financial means to try something different. And it also coincided with the time when I had maybe a new boss who, let's say... It wasn't I didn't get on with him, but he just wasn't somebody I gelled with, so to speak. And it became clear that my career wasn't going anywhere in the IT world. So it was a mixture of bad circumstance leading to good circumstances on the financial side, and also the fact that I'd always wanted to write books. I gave up my job, and I was originally just going to carry on doing IT work as like IT contract work. So we started an IT contracting company. But then what I decided to do in my notice period, I read this book called Write, Publish, Repeat by the guys who run the Self-Publishing podcast, which is a longer established show. And I thought, well, I can do this. I can self-publish some of my books. So I quickly... The major thing that book made to my difference to my process was... that their thing was write the first draft of your book as fast as possible, then go back and change it. And that's what I did with these 3 novellas, which are all time travel based. I would say that actually time travel is not the best genre to start writing in because it's just tremendously complicated.
Yeah.
You have to make sure that you track everything round.
Yeah.
So I self-published those in 2014, So they were about 20,000 words each. So it's a reasonable length to start. And they're only available as ebooks. So I probably will create a compendium version with all three as a paperback at some point, but I haven't got around to that at the moment. And then every year since, apart from last year when I'm actually working on a different book, I've written a fantasy novel each year in the NaNoWriMo. You know, you've heard of NaNoWriMo.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. I've never really been a full-time writer. I tend to write in bursts, in big chunks. And then the rest of the year I'm doing other things. I'm podcasting, or I'm doing social media work, or I'm doing other bits and pieces. So, yes, that is kind of my journey. And now I'm working... I mean, the funny thing is that in that process of learning to self-publish and to market books and to do other things, I actually got more interested in the marketing side than I was in the writing book side. So now I'm working on a book about social media and how to use social media to get ahead as an individual. And that's my latest project. But I'm doing that in a slightly different way as well, because I've got so much experience with audio. I mean, it's my Begin Self-Publishing podcast is like a weekly, well, it's now 2 weeks, once every 2 weeks I interview people. My new book is a collection of interviews I've recorded as audio, and also my own like audio recording. So I'm going to start it first as an audio book and then get it transcribed and edited as a paperback book later. So I'm kind of doing things differently for the latest book, and it's going to be my first foray into nonfiction.
Great. So now did you say, so how are you recording the audio yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, like we're talking on Zoom at the moment. What I have done is I've interviewed about 30 people on Skype calls, and I've recorded that audio. I'm used to doing that. I mean, it's one of the things, make use of the skills you've already got.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get those interviews transcribed. And obviously, there is a world of difference between the audio, how we talk, and how the transcription is.
Right.
If you've ever had any of your shows transcribed, you know that they don't necessarily read well straight away. They need work to edit. So, yes. So the new book is going to be basically an audio book first, and then I'm going to transcribe it and get it edited afterwards. So there's a different approach. All my previous books, I just wrote as normal books as fast as possible, and then went back and edited it and edited and edited. So that's kind of my process.
And it's probably easier with nonfiction to do that process of speaking it and then transcribing it, because there's so much, like there's a lot of the things that you would say or tips you would tell, or, you know, any of the interviews, a lot of that is tactical advice that's pretty easily spoken and then translated to writing. Whereas there's a lot of things in fiction that has different nuances of communication that are harder.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for example, if you were trying to transcribe a fantasy novel, even the fantasy names can be like difficult to somebody to transcribe. So yeah, you're right. It's a very different kind of genre.
Yeah. So I was impressed with the fact that you have written a novel each year during NaNoWriMo. So basically,
yeah.
1 month per year.
Yeah. I mean, that's the first draft. So but in the self-publishing community, that's not that fast, to be honest. There are like self-publishers I know who are writing a novel every 2 or 3 months.
Wow.
So that is all they do, literally. Yeah. That is kind of all they do. I mean, I had an advantage because I was from a programming and IT background. I can almost touch type, so I can type very quickly.
Yeah.
I think it's something that people underestimate. I mean, obviously, you've got this brain and thinking process that goes on, and you've probably got a plan of some kind. I mean, I always work from a lot of the rest of the year was spent writing plans for the NaNoWriMo novels. So it's never a case of like you just go in there and you have no idea what your story's going to be about at the start of the month, and you like, because you just end up writing yourself into a hole that you can't get out.
Right.
So you kind of need to know the start, the middle, and the end roughly.
Right.
But being able to type quickly does make a difference to how fast you're able to get those words down. And you wouldn't think so, but that is one of the true things. So a lot of authors are using speech to text. So they're recording it and then transcribing it. So, yeah, it's possible to write very quickly.
Yeah.
So obviously your NaNoWriMo process, a lot of it is you plan what you're going to actually write during the year. But then you're also doing the podcasting, and you're also doing social media work, and you have a publishing company where you help others publish their books. And so what are your daily habits and routines? How do you structure your day so that all of that gets done? And obviously, you're not writing every single day for your novels, but you're creating, you know, you're creating every day, whether it's a podcast episode or marketing content. So how do you structure your day?
Well, there's the answer of what I should do, and then there's what I do. I would say it's not necessarily optimum at the moment. But the advice I will give in terms of what the optimum setup would be, and the funny thing is, because I was from an IT management point of view, I used to do a lot of what's known as the Scrum process, where you're looking for tasks and you're moving them around. That's what I would do. But another thing that I've started to do intermittently, but hopefully I'll get more persistent than that, is thinking about notifications. Now, we've all got phones and they've all got Facebook on them and things will pop up and the rest of it. I've been moving away from the normal built-in notifications on those apps and on the PC to my own set of notifications. So, for example, with my podcast, and I'm actually, funnily enough, my processes are much better for my podcast than they are for my writing, which is where I need to go beyond on the extra step. But I've got like a Twitter list of previous guests on my show, and I've got one of potential guests on my show.
Nice.
And I've got a notification that says at like 10 o'clock in the morning, check the list of the guest list on Twitter. And I go down looking through them, retweeting, commenting on those things to give back a bit to the people who have been guests on my show. But it's helped me maintain those relationships with people.
Yeah, great idea.
And you can do this kind of notification process with anything, because what you're trying to do is build up habits that are helpful. Now, at the moment, I'm kind of a bit, so I do it most of the time, but sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm busy with something else, so I'm doing it. But it's to try and build that habit up. You want the habit of thinking that I will exercise at this time, I'll do this at this time. Sometimes you just can't do it, but it's for building those habits up so that you don't have to be reminded eventually. You can take it off your phone and get to the next step.
And that's so important, because a lot of authors especially, and just creators in general, they're like, how do I balance creating stuff? How do I balance keeping up with all the people that I need to keep up with? And so that's very smart, having those lists.
Yeah. I mean, I actually, on my podcast, I went from weekly, early last year, I went from weekly to once every 2 weeks. And that was because I was purely doing stuff for the podcast. I mean, in terms of like services for helping authors, it's not as developed as it should be. I've done a little bit of consulting work for people, but not too much. But the thing that is hard, and I know this because I know lots of people who run social media agencies, and even for people who their full-time job is to be like social media marketers, if they're on their own, they're struggling to keep up with it.
Right.
So if you're a writer and you're trying to do, you have to be so organized. You have to be like, because the trouble is you can't just say, set up Facebook and put a post out every week and say, like, here's my book. Because, A, it's not going to work.
Right.
If you're thinking about why people go on Facebook, they're not going to, even if they're your friend, they're not going to just see that you've got a new book out there and, like, send it out. You've got to do more than that. And it's the same with Twitter and all the other services. So there is a time commitment. But I actually do think that social media is possibly the best platform for authors. But there is a real time commitment to it. I think it takes a lot longer than people think to get right.
Which social media platform do you favor?
I would say, I say to most people, start with Twitter. Now, that may not work for every genre and every kind of book. But the thing is, you can build relationships. This is ironically the theme of the book that I'm sort of recording the audio for and talking about at the moment, in that I realized that I'm absolutely terrible at selling books on sites like Twitter, but I've been fantastic at making connections with people. I've got people who know me who've got like blogs with millions of followers on them. People I've had guests on my show who are in the marketing industry, very influential, and also in social media marketing. I know a lot of people. I've got a great network of friends and other connections, and I've introduced people to other people. And I, the theme of the book that I've noticed, and this is from talking to other people, is that I think something like Twitter is useful to authors because they can connect with somebody. Maybe not like every one of their readers they're going to be able to connect to, but they may connect with other authors in their genre. They may connect with book bloggers and other people. And it may be the case that if you're a creative writer and you're looking for a job, what you should be looking at is looking to make connections with somebody in a company that you're interested in. So let's say you're a technical writer and you wanted a job and you haven't got a job at all at the moment. Now, if you go and you go onto LinkedIn or you go into Twitter and you look for people, say, Google's technical department or whatever, and you start making friends with them, you create them on a list, you look to see what they're tweeting about. Some of them you won't be able to make friends with because they're not people you connect with. There might be somebody likes fishing and you like fishing, and you can talk to them about fishing for a while. Because I've been there on the corporate side. If you're looking to recruit somebody, it's a lot easier to recruit somebody you already know than somebody where you have to go through HR, you have to pay for a recruitment agency, you have to interview process. If there's already this person you know because you've been talking to them about fishing on Twitter, and then you also know that they are a writer, and maybe you've sent them some free material or something along those lines. That is a way for a lot of people to get permanent or other works via social media. So social media is fantastic for that. And I think that's, people's a little obsessed with trying to sell stuff online, but actually it's the other connections that are much more valuable.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of different directions we can go with that, because there's so much, like you said, to learn and discover about how to use the social platforms. But one of the things I think that most writers and authors who aren't already social media experts might wonder is, can't you interact and develop relationships and have conversations on Facebook equally well? What is it about Twitter that allows people to form better connections?
Well, I mean, a lot of the time you will end up on Facebook talking to these people. The reason why I suggest starting with Twitter is that Twitter is a totally open and public platform. So let's say you're on Facebook, you can search in for Google's marketing people, but they're going to be talking to their friends. You're not going to be able to look at what they're sharing on Facebook.
Yeah, it's a good point.
There is one exception to that, actually, which is if the person is doing public Facebook Live broadcasts or some kind of broadcasting live thing, then commenting on that is probably a better way than going on Twitter. Because I don't know if you've done many Facebook Live broadcasts. I've done the odd one. I like to do them with other people. I'm not really keen on doing them on my own. But they are very, very frightening to do as a creator. And the last thing you want to do is to do one and nobody comments whatsoever. I mean, you have to do it for a while. So if somebody comes on and they start commenting, they're regularly watching your show, how connected are you going to be with that person? Mm-hmm. So that's where I say, like, Facebook might be a better situation in that case. But a lot of the time, Facebook, everything's locked up and guarded because it's not public. And Twitter, everything's public. I mean, you can see, I mean, apart from the messaging, but 99% of the stuff on Twitter is public. So for that initial introduction, start with Twitter and then maybe try and get them onto Facebook as a Facebook friend. People will vary on how they, I mean, I've got about 550 Facebook friends, of which about 120 or so I've met in real life. But I do know most of them more or less to some extent. I've seen them, I've commented on them. So Facebook is a valuable place for authors and creative people. But I would start with Twitter because it's open and you can search. If you go to the advanced search tab on Twitter, you can search by all sorts of things. You can search by local areas on Twitter.
Mm.
You know what, that's interesting you mentioned that, because also other marketers like Gary Vaynerchuk and other people have mentioned the Twitter search being one of the best avenues for looking into conversation and what people are talking about, what people are asking about. And a lot of people have built, you know, and as I look back at different articles I've read over the years, one of the articles that, one of the themes that has cropped up is the theme of people meeting the right connection that they need to either get a job or get a sponsor or get, you know, whatever they need to move their career forward. I've heard and read articles about that happening via Twitter far more than any other social media platform. And I mean, in terms of the last 2 or 3 years, maybe the only other platform that would compare would be Instagram, because a lot of Instagram is public now as well, and it's more like the photo version. So that's a good point. And when authors are on Twitter specifically, a lot of authors that I've noticed, because I've followed several, and a lot of them, it's like promote, 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 promote all day long. And either they're promoting a blog post or they're promoting their book to buy. What do you recommend? What are your tips, like 3 or 4 tips for authors to actually, you know, create the conversation and have a vibe where I'm actually communicating with you, I'm not just pushing all my stuff on people?
Well, I mean, there is an element of, you do need to do a little bit of pushing of your books. I mean, this is something that I'm looking to improve in 2018. Though I think that you probably don't want to be in general doing just, here's a link to my book on Amazon.
Right.
Something that I need to go through and trawl through my books and do the proper marketing exercise is almost doing like a lot of mini trailers for your products. So, you know, if you go to a cinema, and I'm not sure that cinemas are that, we've all got Netflix and all the rest of it, but if you go to a cinema on the old traditional day, you sit through and you watch trailers at the beginning. Some of those trailers are brilliant. And I've been in cinema, I've watched trailers, and I thought, I want to watch that film because of that exciting moment.
Right.
That is the sort of promotional stuff that authors should be doing on Twitter, on the other platforms. Not just like, if you had a big, you're in the sitting in the cinema and there's a big screen saying like, Last Jedi's, you can watch it here. And that's all it says. That is the equivalent to what most authors do on Twitter.
Yeah.
But you're right in that that should only be a small portion of what people are doing. They should be doing things like Twitter chats are fantastic. If you can find the right one or start the right one, what a Twitter chat is where there's a hashtag and everybody's talking about a topic on it. It's usually at a set time of day. If you can find one about your book subject matter, then that's a brilliant place to get to know people, because they'll be answering the questions and talking to each other. Not that go in there saying like, here's my book, but getting to know people. And as I say, you should be keeping Twitter lists. Twitter lists are, you've got the people you follow on Twitter and the people who follow you back. Now, I generally follow back most people who aren't trying to sell pornography or radical political views. I follow most people back. So I've got a massive Twitter stream, and I can't look at everything. I mean, this is the whole thing about Twitter.
Yeah.
But you can create Twitter lists or particular groups of people. And there are applications like Hootsuite where you can monitor those lists. And that's where the notifications come in. You can monitor lists of people you're interested in, people you're friendly with. And the thing is, like, if you retweet their stuff because you appreciate what they're doing, then a lot of the time they will retweet your stuff. It's still got to be good stuff. And that's where the trailer element comes in. Because they may look at it and they think, oh, that's actually interesting. I may want to do that. And then you've got somebody with a lot of followers on Twitter who's then retweeting your stuff. So I think you're right in that a large chunk of it should be social building up of relationships rather than like, here's my book. It's not a digital billboard. It's a kind of intercommunication mechanism, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So what kind of one of the drawbacks or challenges is that authors and writers, they like to associate with each other in groups and things in the social platforms, and yet they rarely are each other's customers. So, you know, they just don't buy other people's books regularly because they're too busy writing. And so what kind of things do you do as a writer and recommend to writers? Like, what kind of groups, what kind of conversations? In particular, fiction writers. I mean, you're writing a nonfiction book now, and that's easier, in my opinion, in my experience, to market. You know, because it's content, it's information, it's things people want to know.
And you can break down that information into bite-sized chunks for you know, promotional trailer purposes.
Right, but the challenge for fiction authors, of course, is how do you promote a fiction, you know, book? And I know that you can promote excerpts or post excerpts of your writing, talk about characters, but it would really be good to, we're really trying to build a larger picture of, you know, who's doing what's working for people with fiction and social media posting.
Well, I mean, part of the reason why I'm writing a nonfiction book is for that very reason, that it's easier to market it. For my time travel books, I did have some success using social media. The fantasy books less so. I've not given up at all. So maybe ask me in a year or so about that. But for the time travel books, actually, it was Goodreads, the Goodreads communities, where I had the most traction. And that is because it was full of people who were readers of the books. Yeah. There were authors on there. But there was a specific time travel group, and it was very good in terms of making connection with people to actually read the books. Now, for the kind of fantasy I wrote, that didn't necessarily work particularly well. So you are looking for communities. You've either got to build one yourself, which is hard work. So that is maybe having a blog about the themes of your book. Not specifically your book, but let's say you're writing crime thriller or something, and it's about like 18th century London crime, Jack the Ripper killer or something, then having a blog about like crime in the 18th century and trying to attract people who are interested in that particular historical area is the sort of thing that you should be doing as a writer, not starting a podcast about self-publishing like I did. I think this is the trouble, in that content marketing, I think, is probably the best cheap way of doing it. But again, it's a lot of time. I mean, content is very time consuming and it has to be really good and relevant. And I think most of us write too much or record too much content. We'd be better off focusing on writing the best content we can. And then possibly, I mean, if you've got the resources to pay for some promotion for that as well.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And before we move on from that topic, could you explain a little bit about Goodreads? I've heard it from several people, but for our audience, could you just briefly explain what is Goodreads and how they can use it for attracting readers?
Well, Goodreads is an online reader community. It's really like an online readers social media network in a way. Set up of various forums, and you can see what books people have read. It's actually owned by Amazon now, so there is a certain amount of crossover. But there are communities about topics on Goodreads. It's a reader's social media network in a way. A lot of authors hate Goodreads because, generally speaking, the review levels on Goodreads are a lot lower than on Amazon for reasons which I'm not entirely sure why. I think it's more that in Goodreads, they tend to be more hardcore subject-based readers, and they don't want to give 5 stars to something because they don't, unless it's the best book ever. So I think there's a different rating on Goodreads.
Yeah, so along those lines now, you back to the Twitter and the growing the audience and the Goodreads.
Yeah.
Goodreads is a free reading platform, right?
Yeah.
And Twitter is, of course, you're doing the work and it's not, and a lot of it's not selling anything. You're building relationships. And then, you know, we heard on your podcast, somebody was talking about InstaFreebie.
Yeah.
And where your guest said, sorry, I don't remember his name right now, but Paul Teague.
Yeah.
Paul Teague said that he had great success with InstaFreebie. But what's not clear, and so that's why we're glad to be able to interview you and ask you that today, is growing an audience is one thing, and we all know that that's important, but it's even more important to grow the right kind of audience, and that is an audience of readers who might actually be interested in what you're offering. So where do you see that sorting out and all between what we've been talking about, Twitter, Goodreads, and InstaFreebie and such?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, sites like InstaFreebie, and let's explain what InstaFreebie is to people who don't know. This is a service where you can download a free copy of a book in return for giving your email address. And InstaFreebie, typically they run giveaways where there's 20 or 30 books together in a big giveaway. And then when you sign up, you get the books you want, and each author of those books gets your email address. So, I mean, I've done a few InstaFreebie giveaways myself, and I've got about 600 email addresses from that. Now, from what I can tell, these are people who are interested in free books. They are probably interested in free books in your category. So they're not totally useless, but that isn't as great as, say, having a community of people you've met in a specific group who you've seen have previously bought and purchased books. But any audience is better than no audience. That's something that's always worth remembering. And certainly, there is a lot of crossover with the old internet business world with email lists, in that people say, like, oh, only 2% of an email list will ever buy anything. I don't think if you've created a decent audience, it should be that low. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of like 600. It's like 2% of that is 12 people might buy in my book. Yeah, you're right. I think the more focused you can be in your followers and your email signups and this, the better. But just having some sort of strategy for building up followers is worth having.
And have you done much with Amazon ads for books? I know that we've sold on Amazon platforms, products and whatnot, but in the book niche, it's interesting because for the longest time, you couldn't advertise.
Yeah.
And then they came out with the Amazon selling services, and we've heard several authors have really honed in on using that and get sales from that. So do you guys do that as well? Are you noticing success from that?
Not something I've done personally. It's on my to-do list to try out on the Amazon ads side of things. I've heard lots of stories of people being very successful with it. The biggest issue actually is it's very hard to spend your money on Amazon ad book ads. Their algorithm is a bit broken at the moment. So I've heard stories of like people having uploaded like 10,000 different keyword combinations just to try and get the amount of like hits necessarily to do it. So yeah, it's probably the most promising avenue for just generic. That and the giveaway. I mean, there are sites like BookBub for fiction is basically the holy grail that everybody wants.
What is it called again? BookHub?
Bub. So book and then Bob. And what they do is they have built up, I mean, what companies like BookBub have done, and they are the biggest, are they have built up huge, like sort of, I think, million odd lists of readers of books. And then they charge authors to be able to promote their book to their specific subject email lists. And because they've got so much demand for their services, they can like say, we want your book to have 50 five-star reviews. And it's almost kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy in that like the best books then get promoted and then they get like. So certainly for fiction, trying to get something like BookBub, and there are other ones like Free Booksy was one I've heard mentioned for free books, where people have literally built up email lists specifically full of readers where you pay them to submit. And that's probably much more valuable use of your money than, say, Facebook advertising and possibly Amazon ads. So, as I say, apparently Amazon ads are really hard to actually spend the money on. So that's...
What do you have aspirations to make your revenue that you earn from your writing become equivalent to the full-time income?
Yes.
and like, what do you see? So what is your path to that? What do you see as the best path to that?
Well, I mean, one of the advantages to writing an interview-based book for the social media side of things is that I've interviewed like about 30 or 40 people who a lot of them have large social media following. A lot of them, I know a lot of people in social media. And it's a book about social media where people are talking about social media. So they will be able to help me promote the book when it becomes available. Now, I think it's always important to state to people that books don't generally make that much money. Actually, there's more money in fiction than there is in non-fiction in general, unless you're writing, say, like a self-help book or something like that. I've done a number of interviews with this guy called Alex Newton, who does all his analysis at the Kindle ebook store. And there are, like, there is bonsai tree category where you can sell one book and become number one best Amazon bestseller in. And there are quite a lot of non-fiction categories where you can say you're a bestseller when you've sold five books. Right. On fiction, it's unless you're sort of underwater cyberpunk category or some strange one, there aren't really that many easy categories to sell in. I've actually forgotten the original question now. You know, you start on a tangent.
You're talking about your pathway to making your writing earn a full-time living. And I think are you talking about Emmanuel Nataf, who was, is he one of the ones that you talked about? Sorry, when you mentioned a guy that had it broken down by earnings, was that Emmanuel, the guy that you interviewed?
No, that's a different one, actually. I talked to him about how much it costs to self-publish. Okay. Alex Newton is the person you want to look up.
Okay, because you have a good on your site, we'll link to that shows author income. And you know, these are really important. So we'll get back to the question we asked for you to answer in a second, but I think this is all of what you said is so important, and that is that it is really important to realize that generally books don't make a lot of money.
Yeah.
There are all ways to do it, and most of us don't have all the answers, and that's what we're here to discover, you know, and that's what you're working on, that's what you're in the pursuit of. So in your pursuit to make writing earn a full-time living, what are your plans, your avenue for that?
Well, I mean, what you see with self-publishers of all varieties, well, there are generally two types of people making money from self-publishing. There are, as I say, the people who are almost industrially producing, say, a book every 2 months, typically in long series of books. So if I wrote, like, crime, and I wrote 12 books in a long series, and they're all, like, 50,000 words long, and they're all selling for $2.99 or something along those lines, then somebody's going to buy one, and an awful lot of people are buying the follow-through books in the series. So that's what a lot of like people, like Adam Croft is a guy I interviewed who has been number one in the whole of the Amazon store. That's the sort of thing he does. Mm. But then there's the other side, which is what I would do, was where you write non-fiction or you actually write fiction, and then you look at things like speaking or consulting or selling courses based on things associated with your work.
So you're making
money
on the back end when you're doing the nonfiction.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I will, if this book becomes a hit, which I hope it will be, then I will then be able to start looking at doing consulting and educational courses about how to use social media to get ahead and to make those connections. So it's kind of like the book can be a basis for all sorts of things, all sorts of other income. So that's important.
Yeah, that's a good point. Speaking engagements as well as joint authorship, like being interviewed.
Yeah.
Books like yours, essentially. So that leads to more, you know, it really is, there were so many authors that we've spoken with, and there's no easy answer because the and it's similar to digital photographers. There's such a proliferation. Anything digital, really.
Yeah.
It's so easy to access so much content for free. I mean, magazines, same way. Magazines basically are falling into a non-existent category in exchange for authority websites, which, you know, then proliferate the information for free and get hopefully paid in revenue from advertisers and affiliates. But what about authors? And because you're putting in your blood, sweat, and tears, writing it, and it is your job, it's really an interesting thing. It's a little distressing for creatives when people seek out, I want the free book, give me the free book, without kind of consider, and it's understandable. We've all done it and we all do it. Mm. And that is, oh, awesome. I can get that book for free. Absolutely. Right. Without thinking what's behind that and the effort that went into creating that book in the first place, which in some cases is an entire year of writing it. Right.
Yeah.
So it's a good point that, you know, it's sort of like,
and then before you, yeah. And then also the various streams where the book loses money. So you've written the book, however long that takes, and then you pay for the editor, and then
yeah.
You pay for copy editors and story editors, and you know, it's a very interesting industry where it's almost like the money is being made along the way, and then you're like, wait a second, well, I'm the author who actually had this idea. I'm the one who actually got this ball rolling. And so it's just, you know, as you were talking about, it's very interesting the kind of the income trail of where the book loses money and then how hard it is to then make the money. Because when you sell your first several batches of books, you're still working on earning back what you've spent on the editing and any advertising.
Yeah. I mean, one thing to keep in mind, though, is that it's not quite as gloomy as that, certainly if you self-publish, in as much as... Yeah, even if your book doesn't sell that many copies to begin with, because if you use print on demand, it's available and they'll print off a copy when you need it. You don't need to spend on print copies.
Right.
If your book suddenly takes off in, say, a year or two's time, when maybe you've written another book that's actually made you famous for something completely different, or a follow-up book,
yeah,
then your first book will start earning money. So... that you've still got this book available for the rest of your life, and it could take off.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing is, once it starts taking off, then you've got things like you can start selling rights to the book. So you could sell the audio rights to the book to a company, or you could sell the Indian language rights. So there are a lot of potential upstream things. But I think it's correct to say, don't write a book to expect riches now. Write it as an investment for the future, when hopefully, I think you've got copyright plus 50 years after your death. So this is something you can leave to your children or relatives or whatever.
Yeah.
But don't expect to be rich after writing a book, at least within... Don't even expect it to break even in, say, a year or two, unless you're particularly good at marketing or it's particularly a good hit. But in 10, 20 years' time, may well make its money back.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good point in terms of, so for writers who do a lot of research and where it does take a year to write a book, that's harder. Those who get into some kind of rhythm and ability to crank out a book a month kind of thing, you know, that's easier to build up that legacy, you know, a larger legacy that, you know, will build that foundation that you speak of. So what tips do you have for fiction writers to help them speed up the process in order to, I mean, you mentioned, for instance, your time travel books were harder because there were so many back and forth pieces you had to keep straight throughout. And if you change one piece in this chapter, you have to go back the others and change it all, right? So what have you learned in the process of how to increase your efficiency as a fiction writer?
Well, I mean, planning is important. I know I'm setting into a religious war when you talk about planning and pantsing, as they call it. People who write, see, the pants are called pantsers. Like Stephen King writes all his books unplanned and just... personally, I think the better your plan is, the better your book's going to be. And that is keeping a note of things like whether your characters have died in one scene and you've not suddenly brought them back in the next one. What time it is. I mean, it's something in my fantasy book, the time, I suddenly realized I have no idea what season it is in a particular book, how many seasons after the first book started. So the more information you can put in your plan and you can write, the easier it will be to keep track of everything. So I know this isn't probably the most thing that creative people want to say. We want to write, just go to sit down and write an exciting book. But you need some level of consistency. And it's funny because writing time travel, there are some parts of it are very difficult to write. But then in fantasy, I thought fantasy would be easier to write, and it's not. Because fantasy, you've got to keep consistent with your own weird world that you create. And you create strange things, and you can't just suddenly change them later on because you don't feel like it.
Right.
You start off creating a world, and then it's all about world building in fantasy. Where time travel is keeping track of what the hell was going on. So there are the different problems with each kind of fiction that you write. And I think there is a right genre for everybody in terms of what they're good at writing and what they're interested in. And it's just a case of finding that, really.
Finding it, and then, yeah. And I think, like you were indicating, relative to your efficiency with your podcast, there are some things that you're doing there that you can apply to your writing. So looking at our personal habits and seeing what habits we can inculcate into our daily rhythm of creating that helps speed up and make that process more efficient.
There
is a way, you know, it's just a matter of thinking about it differently.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that has struck me as a Gen X person in this, everybody's labeled by generation now, coming to the sort of online business world, is that it's no easier to be a success than it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago. But what it is a lot cheaper to try.
Yeah.
It's just so much cheaper. You can do stuff at home, and you can. And I think the trouble with a lot of people, and I know from my generation, they still have this mindset. Of they think, well, I can't do this because I've got to live in my house in the middle of the city. And it's like, well, if you're just writing books, you don't need to be based in, say, San Francisco, in the most expensive area of town. Why don't you just move somewhere a lot cheaper and use that time to be able to get good at the actual writing of craft side of things? And that's something that's changed a lot. We all tend to think about we have to be in the city to do the job that we're doing where we're in an office. But you don't, if you want to be creative, then you don't need to do that. You can be somewhere else that's cheaper. And I think a lot of people, they want it to be some sort of magic giveaway where they get loads of money coming in instantly successful. But a lot of the time it's just cutting down and realizing there's a lot of stuff that we have to do as part of a job. We have to be commutable, we have to do like into the city center. They don't apply as a creative person. You can be based anywhere in the world. You don't even have to be based in the US or UK. You can move to Thailand and find somewhere cheaper to live. So I think there's a lot of scope for financial kind of cutting back, which actually makes very little difference to people.
That's good. That's such a good point, because I think many times what we do, and I certainly have done it, is we romanticize the end game of what we want, as opposed to, okay, well, no, you don't do it because, you know, you want to be rich and famous and like have this idealistic place where everything's perfect and you get great ideas. You do it because you like doing it. And then you like doing it and you realize, well, I can do this anywhere. And then you just get away from this romantic vision of, you know, like you were talking about, needing to be in the perfect setting. Like, no, nobody sees that. Nobody sees that. You know, they don't see you sitting there writing your book. So it does not matter. The only thing that the reader or the viewer of your content cares about is that it's good quality.
Yeah.
So that's such a good point.
Yeah. And it's like, sorry, I lost my thought. All right. It was just like, oh, well, it'll come back. Or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the people I've talked to have been successful authors, and they're certainly on the self-published side. Virtually all of them have made some kind of sacrifice in terms of where they live or what kind of job they do, or even in some cases with relationships. Because it's given them the time to get good. I think the idea that you're going to be suddenly just instantly a bestseller, your first attempt, is it's a bit naive at times. So yeah, I mean, there is an element of sacrifice, but then a lot of the time you realize that sacrifice isn't actually all that big, really. You just think you want all of these consumer items and things when actually you don't really need most of them.
And the sacrifice is everywhere, no matter what you do, whether it's whatever you choose to create, whether you choose to get that dream job. Well, okay, well, that dream job also comes with its set of sacrifices. You know, so everything is just sort of like you have to be willing to understand the realistic set of life expectations that you're going to walk into to get that exciting thing that you want.
Yeah, which reminds me of what I lost a moment ago. And that is that it really boils down to someone is just casually interested in, oh, it sounds like a fun idea to write a book. I have a story idea. I think I'll write a book about that. Then it might not be, I mean, it's worth trying. Absolutely dive in and do that and give it a try and see what it feels like. But know that in order to have it really go anywhere in the long haul in terms of success as an author, you can earn, you know, being able to earn a living from it, that you need to really kind of come from the mindset, I can't not but write. In other words, you need to have stories in you that you can't, that won't go away, that you need to tell and that you want to write and that you would write no matter what. Kind of thing, and that you're willing to do it for the long haul. But back to your point, anything worth doing is worth working for, and it will take that. It'll take that longevity commitment, essentially.
Yeah, and as you say, there are sacrifices that people make in your 9-to-5 job. For example, I am going to be traveling to the US to a conference in the end of February, and I'm going to be away for almost a month in the US.
Wow.
I couldn't do that if I was just working a 9-to-5 job.
Right.
Now, the fact is that I'm like spending hardly any money the rest of the year to pay for a lot of these trips. That's by the by. But it's like you are sacrificing a lot of freedom in your 9-to-5 job. But there are obviously financial sacrifices, whatever you do. So it's a balancing act. But there isn't some sort of magic button that you can just hit and then you'll be like a million bestseller and people will be buying you golden swans all the time or something along those lines.
Right. Like anything else, it's a journey, right?
And what's great is you can learn from so many other people. I think that's also what's so good nowadays is there's so many other people to learn from. And obviously there's always been many people to learn from, but now it's just easier to access all those people, access their mistakes, their successes, and kind of mesh together something that feels right for you, whether it's working a job part-time so that you have some level of security, because some people do want that security.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing wrong with that. I think sometimes there's this glorification of you have to go all in and you have to do all these ridiculous sacrifices to, you know, get the thing. And you don't always have to do that. You know, you can stage this stuff, you know, it just depends on, you know, your energy, what you want and what you're looking to achieve.
Yeah, we need to bring this to a close for today. So we wanted to close with just asking you two more questions for now. And that is, what people or books are you interested in right now? Like, are there thought leaders that you follow, authors that you follow that inspire you? And or are you, what book are you reading right now or books that are inspiring you?
Well, I kind of given up on the book I was reading at the moment, so I won't mention that one.
Okay, don't mention
But it's what's the last book I read? Well, I usually listen to audiobooks now. I'm a very audio person. It was a very good book by a guy called Mark Schaefer, who I've met actually in person a few times, called Known. And it is about this very struggle to be like an online entrepreneur. And his kind of the thesis of his book, it's a non-fiction book, but is about how you know whether your efforts in, say, content marketing, whether you're actually becoming known or famous in some ways. And it's a very interesting book because it does give you sort of like all the hints of like you shouldn't be sort of like going into competitive niche. And if you're not seeing these sort of things, then you know you're actually not going to be successful. So that was one of the best books I listened to last year. Another book about content marketing is a guy called Marcus Sheridan called They Ask You Answer. And what that is entirely for non-fiction, really, and for it's actually he's a guy who ran a swimming pool company, and his basis about content marketing is basically answering the questions that your customers have. I have interviewed him on my podcast about fiction, and I'm not sure it necessarily works quite as well with fiction, but there is a thing for having a blog or content where you're actually answering the questions that people are interested in your product. Mm-hmm. So that's another interesting book to listen to or read.
Okay. And yeah. Any thought leaders that you follow, like people that you, whose podcasts you follow or that you...
I listen to so many podcasts. A very good one actually is... Under the Influence by, I think it's somebody O'Reilly, which is a CBC Canadian broadcast. He's a guy who's in advertising for years. That's a very good podcast.
Okay.
In terms of blogs and people that I follow, Social Media Examiner are a very good blog to follow.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a Social Media Examiner fan. I go to their conference every year. So.
Okay, cool. Is that the one you're going to in February?
Yeah, that's the one I'm going to in February, yeah.
Good. Well, it's also a nice time of year to be in California.
Yeah. Well, it's always a nice time to be in California, to be honest.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Well, this has been really illuminating, and you've provided a lot of good information and tips on social media, good perspective in general and the realities, and yet hope, you know, of what's possible, and to just for aspiring authors to keep on at it. So really appreciate all you're sharing today, Tim. And do you have any closing thoughts that you would like to share before we go?
I suppose I would just reiterate that point. It's that it's not any easier than it has been, but it's a lot cheaper. And there are so many more opportunities now than there were like 20 or 30 years ago.
Absolutely.
So yes, if one thing doesn't work, try something else. And if that doesn't work, try something else.
Yeah.
And hopefully, fingers crossed, something will work eventually for you.
Absolutely. And whatever you do, keep creating daily.
Absolutely.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been fun.
Thank you as well.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us for the I Create Daily podcast. Please let us know what creatives you would like us to interview and what topics you would be interested in hearing more about.
And if you enjoyed this show, please leave a review on iTunes. We value your feedback. We read all the reviews, and it just helps us get the word out on the I Create Daily podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.